The baby boomers have become the wealthiest and most influential generation in history. Even today, in their twilight years, they hold over 50% of the nation's wealth despite only making up 20% of the population. They are also clinging onto power longer than anybody else has before, turning everything from local city councils to the Senate into glorified retirement villages. It was a unique combination of circumstances and conditions that allowed the baby boomers to get this wealthy and hold on to that wealth for so long. But the one condition that they can't influence is that they are all dying. The youngest baby boomers are now 62 years old, which means on average, this generation is now straddling America's life expectancy. Now, as grim as it sounds, a lot of people are almost excited about this, because it means for the first time in decades, everybody else will get a share of some of that wealth and influence. Unfortunately, the rise and fall of the baby boomers is not going to be quite that simple, and realistically, this great transfer might end up making a lot of these intergenerational inequities even worse.
There's uncertainty surrounding how much wealth baby boomers will be able to hand down to the next generation. Cost of assisted living and medical expenses can significantly deplete the nest egg that boomers have prepared.
Baby boomers and empty nesters are staying put in their big family homes because of a lack of incentives to downsize.
This generational transfer of wealth is coming as baby boomers move out of the workforce and millennials move in.
More than 4 million baby boomers will hit 80 in the next 5 years, and occupancy at senior living communities is hitting new highs.
Biden would be 86 by the end of a second four-year term, while Trump, by 2028, would be 82.
But should age be an automatic disqualifier in politics or any other field?
The average age of a public company CEO is now 58 years old. The average director is 63. The average member of Congress is over 60. And the only reason the incoming Senate isn't the oldest ever elected is because so many of its members are dying in power, pulling down the calculation. If Donald Trump serves his entire term, he will be the oldest president in history, after replacing the oldest president in history. We are not alone. The leaders of the two most populous countries in the world, India and China, are also 74 and 71 respectively. The average person living in the world today is on average ruled over by someone 40 years older than them, and it all happened because of a few small demographic changes. So how the fuck did old people take over the world?
Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin.
President Putin.
You can beat President Putin.
They say a wall is medieval. Well, so is a wheel. A wheel is older than a wall.
And a string of...
Utilities being treated fairly. Charlie. I'm so used to
that. Just say I. Okay, just... I.
Up until 2020, baby boomers were the largest generation in America by a significant margin. And as they moved through their lives, they became a significant and highly politically active voting bloc that could almost single-handedly dictate the policies of the government. When they were young, they could vote for free education and strong social support. When they started entering the workforce, they voted for worker protections, affordable housing, and policies to help raise children. When they got a little bit further in their careers, they owned their homes, they wanted lower taxes, good investment returns, and retirement opportunities. The inconvenient side effect was that meant worker protections, free education, and affordable housing became less of a priority for everybody else that came after them. David Willetts, who is currently a member of the British House of Lords, first popularized this idea in his book, The Pinch: How Baby Boomers Took Their Children's Fortune. Willetts is a politician, demographer, and a baby boomer himself, so his book is definitely worth checking out, so I will leave a link to it in the description. But the thing is, the baby boom wasn't enough to get us to where we are today all by itself. Human populations have boomed and bust throughout our entire history. Plagues, wars, famines, and natural disasters have made some generations bigger than others for thousands of years, and never before has so much power been held in the hands of the elderly. In the past, being part of a large generational cohort would actually be a disadvantage because if you had more peers, that means more competition for resources and jobs. So there is something more going on here. Baby boomers and the silent generation were the largest cohort of their time period, but that time period just so happened to be the most intense period of wealth creation in human history. After the Second World War, widespread industrialization, the automation of domestic chores, women entering the workforce, the adoption of global trade and modern finance made global, and more specifically, American productivity go fucking parabolic. The world is hundreds of times wealthier today than it was in the 1950s, and baby boomers have been able to capitalize on that for their entire lives with their heavy sway on politics. having policy tailor-made to suit their needs in their specific stage of life during the largest creation of wealth ever allowed baby boomers to amass the largest generational fortune in history. And as they have grown older, that wealth has allowed them to turn that wealth into even more influence. But eventually, that power will be lost, making way for the next generation in line. Even if they won't give up their seats willingly, there is always the inevitability of death to even the playing field. Right? Well, it's time to learn how money works to find out why the world is suddenly run by old people, and why it's probably never going to get any better. This week's video is sponsored by Built, and if you were paying rent every month without earning anything back, this is for you. Built is a loyalty program for renters that lets you earn points on your monthly rent payments no matter where you live. Those points can be redeemed for travel with major airline and hotel partners, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, fitness classes, even member-only experiences and more. Plus, when you link any credit or debit card, you unlock access to benefits from over 45,000 local merchants, so you earn Built points on top of your regular card rewards. I love the idea of redeeming points for a weekend getaway through the Built travel portal, because if I am already paying rent every month, I might as well get closer to a trip. And if you are linking a card for everyday spending, always stay responsible and pay it off in full so you can enjoy the points without running up a balance. Built points have been ranked the most valuable point currency by leading publications, and joining is free, which makes earning on rent feel a lot more satisfying. Sign up through the link in my description or use the QR code on screen and make sure you use my URL so they know I sent you. Apple, Microsoft, Google, Sun Microsystems, the Java programming language, and the internet itself all have one thing in common. They are some of the biggest technology companies or systems in the world, sure. But they were all founded, created, or managed by people born in the year 1955. Now, to be fair, Eric Schmidt didn't technically found Google, but he probably had just as big of a role into turning it into what it is today as Larry and Sergey, and he has made billions of dollars in the process. If you want to be president, you should go back a little bit further. Three of the five living presidents were born within 6 months of one another in the year 1946. Now, with such a small sample size and a healthy mix of selection bias, coincidences like this do happen. But people like Malcolm Gladwell have pointed out that this statistical anomaly demonstrates the power of being born in the right time. His book Outliers is one we have referenced on the channel before, and is also definitely worth a read because it provides a lot of insights into how a small bit of luck can cause fundamental differences in outcomes. For boomers, it was a perfect combination of being exposed to new technologies that would go on to change the world and create some of the most valuable businesses in history, and not having that much competition yet. This wasn't just true for founding tech companies and ruling the free world either. Being born in the right place at the right time has helped the oldest people in the world today build up wealth in smaller but arguably more important ways as well. The most obvious factor is housing. Homes in America have never been more unaffordable compared to household incomes, and older generations that have had decades to build up equity in their home, or maybe even some investment properties, are benefiting from this home price appreciation, instead of being crushed by it. Even accounting for the higher interest rates older generations paid on their mortgages, their home ownership rate was much higher than the generations that came after them because the barriers to entry for home ownership were much lower. Today, the gerontocracy is also working to secure that advantage in a slightly less obvious way. According to public records collected by Zipia, the average age of a city council member in America is 52 years old. Now, that's not quite Congress numbers just yet. But remember that city council is often seen as the first step in a political career. So for every 20-something hotshot, there is a real-life Councilman Milton.
Councilman Milton was first elected as a city councilor in 1948 as a member of the Dixiecrat Party. Their platform? Deintegrate baseball.
City councils don't pull the levers of global power like Congress does, but your local elected representatives probably have more influence over your life than the big dogs in Washington. In most municipalities across the country, they influence schooling, local amenities, and most importantly, zoning. These people have the power to radically influence home prices in their cities by allowing for higher density housing or by opening up new areas for development, but across the country, they choose not to. Now, even if the people sitting on these councils are spring chickens compared to other areas of government, the people actually engaged with them are not. According to the National Civic League, only 15-27% of Americans vote in local elections. And of those who do, elderly homeowners are massively overrepresented. According to the same report, those 65 and above are 7 times more likely to vote in local elections than voters aged 18-34. Even local politicians need to listen to their voters. Demographically, based on the people who watch these videos, almost none of you would know who sits on your city council, or even what their policies are, which is a shame because they wield an incredible amount of power, and they are where average people have the best chance at making a real difference. If you have genuinely ever been to a city council meeting or even voted in a local election, comment below and I will take your word for it and bestow you with a useless heart emoji. At least until I get tired and stop reading the comments. Anyway, elderly people have voted for people who will keep their homes valuable, which tends to be more elderly people helping to cement the gerontocracy from the ground floor. So, elderly people were influential at the right time to get rich, and then they use that wealth to buy even more influence. It's a pretty simple cycle. But there is still one thing that doesn't quite add up. There are countries beyond the Great Gulf of America that didn't strike it rich in the second half of the 20th century. Their baby boomers lived tough lives, and even if they were from a country where they could vote, they wouldn't be influencing the economy of a massively wealthy country, shaping it to their will to work for them. They would be voting for the party least likely to take away their basic farm. This is a broad generalization, of course. But it's hard to overstate just how fortunate the USA has been over the last 70 years. There is a graph that is honestly kind of haunting. This is life expectancy at birth for the average global citizen over the last 100 years. There are two noticeable dips, one small one which was caused by COVID-19, and this much larger one from 60 years ago. You might think this was from World War II, but those numbers aren't actually captured on this graph because records were too unreliable from back then. This two-year global dip in life expectancy was caused exclusively by China's Great Leap Forward, an economic plan that was so bad it caused mass starvation and so many casualties it noticeably moved global averages. If American boomers were in the right place at the right time, this was the exact opposite of that. Instead of going on to found a tech company, you would be lucky to make it to your first birthday. The point here is that even still, China is today largely ruled by elderly people. And that's because of the final and most crucial ingredient, inequality. Baby boomers were not only the wealthiest generation in history, they were also the most unequal. Now, before we all go and seize the means of production, it's important to remember that a lot of this inequality was caused by the rich getting richer, even when the poor were getting richer too. The life of a poor boomer was significantly better than the life of a poor person in the 19th century. But the gap between rich and poor grew much more as people built fortunes previously impossible. This means that the world isn't really ruled by boomers, it's ruled by rich boomers. They were just the first group to grab their seats at the table. In China, they just happened to open up conveniently as baby boomers were in key government positions to effectively install their own unique brand of capitalism that unsurprisingly involved making themselves and their close comrades wealthy before anybody else. In fact, even in America, wealth is a big decider of even being around to rule at all. Average life expectancy is way up, and it's continuing to rise, but it's mainly been caused by drops in infant mortality and increases in the lifespan of wealthy people. According to a study published by the National Library of Medicine, the gap in life expectancy between the poorest 1% and the richest 1% was more than 14 years. That's greater than the difference in life expectancy between America and Afghanistan. The study also found that this gap was widening as health technology, diet, and lifestyle advances were resulting in wealthy people living longer, while most of the population was relatively stagnant, especially if they had worked in physical careers. To become an old politician, you first have to become old, and the best way to do that is to stop being poor. The rapid increase in life expectancy has meant that once people get into these positions of power, they are sticking around a lot longer than they normally would have. And if nobody is moving out of these positions, it makes it harder for younger people to move into them. Now, that's most obvious in photos like this, but it's probably an even more serious problem for regular workers around the world who can't move up in the corporate ladder because senior positions are packed with rusted-on executives. Older workers know that it's a lot harder for them to find a new job with a new company, and it's also a lot harder for them to lose their job in the first place. In America, age is a protected class that can't be discriminated against. But only for old people. The law only protects people over the age of 40. Young people are fair game. This has contributed to a trend in the job market where the only way to really increase your position and compensation is to job hop, because even if companies wanted to reward staff loyalty, most of those benefits would go to the boomers. Now, to be fair, some of these people are extremely competent. A decades-long career will give people a lot of valuable experience, valuable connections, and a valuable reputation. What's more is that the old gripe about old bosses making three times your salary while being unable to work their emails is still true in certain circumstances. But even really old people to date have been exposed to technology for most of their careers now, so they are not as behind as the elderly people from a decade ago. And none of this should matter anyway, right? Because even if old people do rule the world, eventually we will be those old people, right? Wrong. First off, it's not ideal to have a system where people are just willing to get old enough to finally get some power, and this shift is already happening. The demographic conditions that made this possible in the first place means that as the current rulers die, they are likely to be replaced with much younger candidates. Elderly people have a lot of tools to cling on to power, but as their poorer peers die off, they are losing their demographic might. This hasn't impacted authoritarian states, because once those people gain power, the will of the people isn't going to compel them to give it up. But in 2024, for the first time in decades, democratically elected leaders around the world actually got younger. This was helped by the fact that almost all incumbent leaders did poorly in last year's elections, and opposition leaders are generally younger, but it also marks a trend in younger voters having more influence over who represents them. So, if you are 40-something waiting to inherit the world, the bad news is that, just like the rest of your life, you are probably going to be skipped over. But the good news is that might be a small price to pay to unseat the gerontocracy. The exception to this global trend was here in America. Now, there is one place where power has been accumulated in the hands of the elderly faster than ever. It's on corporate boards for well-connected people with friends in right places. It's the ultimate retirement gig. In the coming decades, the wealthiest generation in history will die. It's an unfortunate, albeit inevitable, fact of life. But baby boomers will eventually go extinct, and they will pass down over $90 trillion to the next generation within America alone. This much money could fix a lot of problems like student debt, unaffordable housing, inadequate retirement savings, and record credit card debt. But don't get too excited just yet, because at best, the great wealth transfer is a financial illusion, and it could actually just end up making things worse.
This is a setup, a warning of the ugliness to come. The greatest wealth transfer in history is here with familiar rich winners.
The transfer of wealth is underway. As we speak, baby boomers are leaving an estimated $70 trillion to millennial and Gen X heirs.
Baby boomers are the wealthiest generation in history. In America, they control half of the nation's wealth, according to the 2024 wealth report prepared by the property management company Knight Frank. Other sources estimate that baby boomers only hold a mere $78 trillion in assets. That slight difference of $12 trillion is due to what you really define as wealth, and that slight difference in opinion is more than the collective wealth of half the planet. Regardless of the exact methodology used to calculate generational wealth, they all agree on one thing. Baby boomers are the kings, and everybody else has been holding on to whatever is left over. That concentration of wealth has, according to many, come at the expense of younger generations who are now poorer than their parents were at the same age. So that means when life finds a way and this wealth is passed down, it should fix these generational issues, right? Wrong. Counting on an inheritance to fix your own personal finances is a terrible idea. According to a survey by the investment intelligence firm Natixis, 70% of young people expect to get an inheritance, but only 40% of their parents actually plan on leaving one. This means individually, 30% of the young adult population is going to have their financial plans ruined late in their careers when there isn't much time left to make up for it. Okay, so waiting on an inheritance is a dumb thing to do as an individual. But counting on the great wealth transfer globally is just plain irresponsible for three simple reasons. The first is that not all wealth is created equal. $7.4 trillion of the $90 trillion total are held in private businesses, according to data from the Fed. Small operations like HVAC, roofing, machining, mortgage brokering, medical practices, and repair businesses number in the millions across America, but putting a value on them can be extremely tricky. The Fed took estimated EBITDA for these companies, which takes the earnings of a business before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, and then multiplies that by an industry standard valuation multiple. If you own a small business that makes $200,000 per year before these other costs, and you operate in an industry like machinery with an industry EBITDA multiple value of 5, then congratulations, your business is worth $1 million. This is an imprecise art. And naturally, a business is only worth as much as someone is willing to pay for it. which will only cause a problem when all of these boomer-owned businesses get passed down to the next generation. According to the American Medical Association, 49.1% of physicians currently work in practices where the owner is themselves a doctor. That was down significantly since the start of the pandemic, and many of those left are owned by doctors that have had time to get the experience, clientele, and capital necessary to go into business for themselves. If they retire or die, their business doesn't have any value to their children unless they themselves are also doctors in the same field of medicine, an exceedingly rare occurrence. Millions of other owner-operator businesses will close their doors before they can be passed down to younger generations. Now, this is a bigger problem than some trust fund babies not getting handed a free business. If these businesses disappear, it will not only take their services out of the market, it will also stop new entrants into the job market from getting apprenticeships to learn the trades that are already in desperately short supply. But in crisis comes opportunity. The first group that is actually benefiting from the great wealth transfer are investment firms that are buying up these small firms for pennies on the dollar from owner-operators who just want a bit of extra cash before they retire. In a process called rolling up, private equity firms are buying dozens of small businesses and then merging them into one more efficient business that can hire cheaper employees to service the clients of all the old businesses. Sites like BizBuySell, BizQuest, and BusinessBroker.net have become the eBay for small businesses, largely listing businesses owned by retiring baby boomers who are hoping to get something rather than just shutting them down. There is one other problem with all this private business wealth too. The 50 largest private companies in America are all almost exclusively owned by baby boomers. Without the financials of these private companies, putting an accurate value on them is almost impossible. But based on comparables, these top 50 are collectively worth an estimated $2 trillion, conservatively. So, almost half of the wealth in this asset class is just 50 companies. Unless your family name is Bloomberg, Mars, or Coke, the value of the boomers' private companies is not something that is going to impact your life. But that's only one small part of the great wealth transfer. Boomers reportedly own $16.9 trillion in durables and other assets ranging from rusty old home appliances to motor yachts. Some of these goods could be sold by a beneficiary, but a lot of this paper wealth is, in reality, going to end up being a financial burden to maintain if it's not just simply disposed of. Rounding out the wealth that might not do much good to the next generation, pension plans have been calculated on what they are worth to the boomers themselves based on assessing how much money someone would need to replace that cash flow. A pension that pays out $50,000 a year to a retiree could have an on-paper future value of $1 million. But that doesn't mean that a beneficiary is going to receive $1 million when their parents die. So with that, the great wealth transfer has already been cut in half. But that still leaves $40 trillion in cash, equities, and most importantly, housing that is going to be passed down in the coming years, and that's gonna fix a few things, right? Baby boomers' second largest asset class is their homes and investment properties. The generation owns almost as much real estate as the Generation X and Millennials combined, and controlling this much of the market has caused problems for everybody else. According to a survey conducted by the real estate firm Redfin, about half of homeowners and renters said they have periodically struggled this year to afford their mortgage payment or rent as rates have increased and have been passed along to the people on the bottom of the housing ladder. The survey also found that to keep up with payments, some homeowners and renters had resorted to selling their belongings, picking up overtime shifts, canceling vacations, working a second job, and even skipping meals to keep up with their payments. Housing has simply become a major expense for everyone, except for those who have had the opportunity to purchase a home when they were affordable and the time to pay their mortgage off in full. The great wealth transfer of housing on the surface looks like a ghoulish, albeit pragmatic, solution to this problem for two simple reasons. The first is that it could provide millions of people with a house of their own to live in. The second reason is that even if you receive a home as an inheritance that you don't want to live in, you can just sell it, which is good for you and good for the market because it provides supply at a time when almost nobody wants to sell their home. So, what's the problem then? Well, again, less housing than you would expect is actually going to be passed down. A study published by the National Library of Medicine has found that a majority of lifetime healthcare costs for the average person happens after they turn 65. This is an immediate problem, because according to a study by the health research organization KFF, only half of people over 65 have anything saved to pay for healthcare costs in retirement, and the overwhelming majority of adults won't have enough money to pay for senior living care, which is now estimated to be over $100,000 per year. Medicare, which is the government-provided health insurance program for seniors, does not support senior living. So, many seniors will add a Medicare Advantage plan, which is an additional out-of-pocket expense. So, housing will be handed down, but it's primarily going to be handed down to reverse mortgage companies or sold to cover spiraling senior living costs. According to Freddie Mac, the total value of cash-out refinances and second mortgages has already doubled since 2019, as even people who do own their own home have trouble keeping up. So far, the Great Wealth Transfer is going to consolidate small businesses, financialize homes even further, drive up medical costs, strain government services, and increase household debt. But there is still hope. There is one asset class left, and it's the biggest of them all. Baby boomers hold on to more equities and fixed income securities like stocks and bonds than millennials have between all of their assets combined. But when you think about it, that doesn't really make sense. For most people, their biggest asset is their home. Participation in the stock market is at record highs thanks to investment vehicles like 401ks and IRAs, as well as technologies that make investing easier like cheap online brokerages. According to the Fed survey of consumer finances, 58% of households owned stock in 2023. Which is a good thing, but it's still lower than the 65% of households that own their own home. Part of this can be explained by people buying stocks because they simply can't afford housing, but that's only a minor factor. This class of assets will actually be handed down in the Great Wealth Transfer, but it doesn't belong to normal people. Despite record participation in the market, the richest 10% of Americans now own 93% of stocks. The bottom 50% of Americans own just 1%. Most shockingly of all, though, the stock market inequality is even more severe amongst baby boomers. Just Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Steve Ballmer, Larry Ellison, Michael Dell, Jensen Huang, and the three surviving Walmart heirs own roughly $1.9 trillion worth of stocks, or 10% of all the equities within their generation. The remaining 70 million baby boomers own the 90% that these 10 people have left behind. The good news for the people in line to inherit a majority of this wealth is that they won't need to wait for it. A New York Times article detailing the way that this wealth is being transferred has found that most of the advantages of the Great Wealth Transfer have already been handed to the people in line to receive it. A growing trend of giving while living means that children from wealthy families with the financial means to maintain their wealth until their death are already getting their college paid for, assistance with buying their first home, and cash to cover the cost of raising their own children. According to a survey from the UK, nearly 80% of children enrolled in the country's private schools had at least part of their fees paid for by their grandparents. If you are in a financial situation where you need the Great Wealth Transfer to help you out, the Great Wealth Transfer probably isn't going to help you. This year, a record number of people will be turning 65, and the next year, that record will be broken again. We have been warned about aging populations for decades now, and now it's actually happening. Unfortunately, the savings retirement gap for millions of households is wider than it has ever been, and people's assets have been eaten up by inflation, bad investments, and good old-fashioned financial illiteracy. Over 20% of the people on the cusp of retirement have no savings at all, but that isn't stopping them. Millions of people across the world can't afford to retire, and they're doing it anyway. So what the f*** does this mean for everybody else?
Baby boomers leaving their homes either because they're moving to assisted living centers or they're just no longer living.
In the last 10 years, Milwaukee County saw a 22% increase of older residents.
Workers in their 50s are generally at peak earning potential, yet more than half worry they'll run out of money in retirement.
Is this the retirement that you imagined?
No.
Earlier this year, the Retirements Income Institute released a commission study on retirement savings. The, and I can't overemphasize how much I love the name of this report, Peak Boomers Impact Study found that between this year and 2030, 30 million Americans will retire, representing almost a fifth of the total labor force. The study focused primarily on how those retirees plan to fund their retirement, and the results were grim. More than half of the study group had less than $250,000 in assets, including their home if they had one. And that group would rely on Social Security as their primary or exclusive source of income in retirement. Now, this study was conducted by independent researchers, but it was funded by a group that wants to sell annuities to people planning their retirement, so some of their recommendations need to be taken with more than a bucket of salt. However, the study group of retirees getting too old to work are just one part of the larger group deciding that right now is a pretty good time to retire. A study by Pew Research has found that the largest wave of retirement has already happened, as people step back from the workforce during COVID, assisted by a combination of record low interest rates, generous stimulus measures, redundancy packages, record asset prices, and a general motivation to not go back into a plague-infested office. This is far from a uniquely American trend. In fact, we are actually behind a lot of countries that are both older than us and have better support systems for people in their old age. On top of hitting peak boomer, there are less typical retirees. A growing number of independently wealthy young people who are pursuing financial independence where investment returns from their assets are enough to fund their lifestyle indefinitely, and on the other end of the spectrum, there are people just giving up on working and are scraping by on family support, government assistance, or jobs in the informal economy. These people aren't the typical demographic of retirees, but they are still adding to the record trend, and they are all paying for this major financial decision in slightly different ways. The first way is that they just aren't. People don't always make entirely rational financial decisions. Whether it's buying a car in an 84-month finance deal, racking up credit card debt to buy luxury goods, or just not understanding the importance of saving and investing, there is no shortage of people doing really dumb things with their money. You are watching a channel that gives weekly depressing lectures on the state of the financial system, business trends, and the economy. So all of you are probably far more financially literate than the average person. And even then, you have probably made some dumb money mistakes. People deciding to quit their jobs often aren't thinking entirely rationally. And more people are just deciding that if they are going to be screwed financially in their old age, they would at least like to enjoy a few years while they still have their health and worry about finances once they are too old for it to be their problem. For some people, the decision is made for them. Layoffs nationwide have hit people approaching retirement age particularly hard. According to a survey conducted by the Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies, most Americans are retiring 5 years earlier than they expected. While this sounds like it's giving people more years to enjoy themselves, the reality is that it's giving people fewer years to save and more years to cover. And this is almost entirely involuntary. According to a study published by ProPublica, since 2016, 56% of workers over the age of 50 lost their job involuntarily, meaning they either got fired, made redundant, or laid off. Now, that might not sound too bad, but you have to remember that a lot of people over the age of 50 are choosing to leave their job because they are retiring on their own terms. So the majority being let go is pushing a lot of people out of work. Once they are out, older people are finding it much harder to find a job, especially ones that pay as well as the jobs they were laid off from. Companies don't want to hire older people because they think that they can't use computers, they aren't going to be able to do physical work for as long as young workers in non-office jobs, and there is the not-so-secret reality that older workers are normally less easy to take advantage of than younger workers with their whole career ahead of them. It's technically not legal to discriminate against workers over the age of 40, although this law does not protect against discriminating against people under the age of 40, but that's a whole separate issue. It doesn't matter anyway, because any half-competent hiring manager or human resources department could find a reason for hiring a young worker instead of an over 50 worker, and this all means the same thing. If people lose their jobs over the age of 50, they are almost forced into retirement whether they can afford it or not. The topic of what to do with aging populations in countries across the world is something that is keeping a lot of policymakers up at night. People are living longer and having fewer children, which means more pressure is going to be put on a smaller group of young people, or elderly people are going to have to make do with less. Of course, a lot of baby boomers are independently very wealthy as they have enjoyed a high level of job security and incredible asset price appreciation over their working careers. A typical white-haired couple driving a gold buggy around a gated Floridian retirement village might be the first thing you think of when you think of boomer retirees, but these people are far from the average. People of retirement age own more than half of the wealth of the country, but that wealth is spread even more unevenly than it is over the general population. There are some extremely wealthy baby boomers, a small group of boomers who will be able to comfortably fund a nice retirement, and millions who are fighting for what little is left. The question is really about what happens when this group just can't work anymore. A study by the Stanford Center on Longevity found that even though baby boomers are the wealthiest generation in history as a whole, they are still facing tougher retirement conditions on an individual basis than their parents did. Some countries are pushing back retirement ages to squeeze a few more years of work out of people before they can receive a government pension or access their Advantage retirement savings accounts. Statistically, most of you watching this video are either at the peak of your career or are only just starting, which is why we have covered the problems you are likely to face if you don't already have a solid plan to retire. But even if pushing back retirement benefits is a necessary evil, it's going to be a hard sell. Retiring baby boomers are a large group, and they vote. The very mention of them needing to work a few more years is borderline political suicide. Most plans here in America center around pushing back retirement for young people who aren't close enough to retirement yet to care. Whatever the plan is, it's not being helped by the millions of people who are dropping out of the workforce. So, the compromise is that the payments are stretched thinner. According to Census Bureau data, poverty rates amongst people over 65 has been on the rise as government programs haven't been able to keep up with general inflation, and certainly haven't kept up with the spiraling costs for aged healthcare and senior living. If people do re-enter the workforce, it's normally into low-wage jobs that only help support other payments. A study conducted by the American Society of Aging found that a fifth of older workers were making less than $15 an hour, and that included people between 55 and 65 who should be at the penultimate years of their career. The authors of this study also pointed out that a lot of this low-wage work is intense, routine, and almost always highly monitored in situations where a person controls neither the pace nor content of their work. Now, you probably don't need an institutional study to tell you that minimum wage jobs are hard, but they are even harder on old people with deteriorating health, which means it could be hard for them to keep this work even if they really need it. When this happens, the last line of support becomes relying on their adult children for care. Now, the idea of your parents moving back in with you might be terrifying enough, but the burden of being a caregiver to elderly parents is disproportionately falling on lower-income households. Lower-income households are less likely to be able to save adequately for retirement and are more likely to have children that are also low-income. When those parents start requiring care from their children, it can impact relationships, career growth, or even how many hours the adult child can put into their work. Additionally, a dependent parent might be a direct financial burden if their assistance payments don't cover their expenses. This means the children are going to be less likely to save for their own retirement, creating a vicious intergenerational cycle. So, what was supposed to be a feel-good story about millions of people leaving behind the 9-to-5 has turned into a lecture about the grim financial landscape that millions of people are forced to contend with. Welcome to this channel. By now, you should know what you have signed up for. But what can be done about this? As a society? Not much, unfortunately. A lot of incredibly smart people are tackling the problem of aging populations, and the solutions so far have been to get people to work longer and live on less. Individually, though, you need to assume that there is not going to be anything there to support you when you are too old to work. Pensions are already strained, and if you have a few decades left in the workforce, there really is no guarantee it will exist at all for you. And if it does, it's probably only going to be enough to cover the bare necessities, if that. So try to set something aside in a 401k or whatever the equivalent is in your respective countries. It's basic stuff. But when so many people cannot or will not do the basics, it could put you a long way ahead. Now, this only applies to elderly retirees. This problem is being made much worse by the millions of people leaving the workforce decades before they would normally retire. There are institutions operating in America today that are responsible for over 20,000 premature deaths, all in the name of profit. They make their money by housing vulnerable people and cutting costs wherever they can, often breaking the law in the process. These might sound like for-profit prisons, but I am actually talking about nursing homes. Although maybe that's no coincidence, because a lot of these places are owned and operated by the same people.
Every nursing home across the country. According to a recent survey, 87% of providers are facing staffing shortages.
You trust in nursing homes to take care of your loved ones, but 2 News investigates found several in our area have received below average rankings.
And exposed insulation in the bathroom.
Nobody should have to live like this.
If you are an investor with a lot of cash and good connections, age living is an attractive business opportunity. The aging population means that you will have an ever-growing number of customers. Revenue can be sourced from insurance companies, individuals, and the government. And once you have residents in your homes, it's unlikely that they will ever check out until, well, they check out. According to research done by the National Bureau of Economic Research, elderly Americans are also less financially literate, which means they won't know if they are getting a good deal or not. The investment potential gets even better the more of these businesses you own, because overhead like administration, sales, and contracting can be shared across multiple locations. Consistent cash flow, a growing customer base, and synergies at scale has made nursing homes one of the most targeted alternative asset classes in America. Investors can now gain exposure to the aged care market through direct investment, private equity, and even exchange-listed real estate investment trusts that can be purchased by anybody with a Robinhood account and $90. But the reality of this business is razor-thin margins, distorted incentive structures, and a race to the bottom on quality and safety. Aged care is a broken business model that smart money investors need to squeeze incredibly hard to get any kind of returns for three reasons. And there are three terrible ways this squeezing is getting done. The first reason is that the profit does not come from looking after the elderly. The National Bureau of Economic Research published a report on the effect of private equity investments into nursing homes, which is one of the most damning things I have ever read. The only reason why it isn't getting more attention is because the report is 30,000 words long. So I have gone ahead and read it so you don't have to. The paper outlines the damage that the private equity business model has done to patient care. But before it even gets to that, it outlines just how broken the aged care business is. Not all senior living is made equal, and the business is operated off three classifications that have different requirements and qualify for different subsidies. The first classification is an independent living facility. These are for seniors who are largely independent but want to live in an environment where they have the community of other seniors, the convenience of having meals, transports, and social events organized for them, and the peace of mind of care facilities being close by if they need them. These kinds of facilities are common in lifestyle retirement states like Florida, and some of them offer luxurious accommodations and amenities to the residents. These aged care facilities are usually privately funded and operate not too differently from a gated community that only allows people above a certain age to live there. Investors in these kinds of facilities make their money by selling or leasing homes directly to residents, leasing commercial properties to businesses that want to operate within the facility, and from charging management fees on top of the fees to maintain grounds, organize activities, and upkeep amenities. Since residents pay out of their own pocket to live in these facilities, the operating companies can charge as much as people are able to pay. A luxury home at The Villages, the largest independent living facility in the country, is currently listed for just under $2.4 million. That is separate from the ongoing fees to stay in the community. More modest offerings for a smaller independent living facility run about $5,000 a month for combined rent and services fees on a one-bedroom apartment. Most retirees fund their stay at these living facilities by selling their homes. So as homes have become more expensive, the prices of these facilities has kept up at almost exactly the same pace. Independent living is, in a way, an indirect way to profit both off the aging population and increasing home prices. So if you are waiting for an inheritance to finally own your own home, I'm sorry to tell you, but these guys are the first in line. Now, these facilities are made for people that are mentally and physically fit enough to live by themselves, so nobody is being forced into these homes. But it starts to get a lot worse at the next level up. Assisted living facilities provide more personal care than independent living facilities. Accommodations in these types of aged care establishments are much smaller than the regular apartments of freestanding homes in ILFs. Typically, they are single ensuite rooms that connect directly to communal facilities like food halls and on-site medical facilities. These homes support residents with daily activities like bathing, dressing, and medication management, but they still let their elderly clients maintain as much independence as possible with planned shopping trips, leaving to go to see friends and family, and even vacations if it's deemed appropriate. These types of facilities are still mostly paid out of pocket by residents, but since they are a blend of a home and a care facility, insurance companies will cover part or some of all of the fees to stay in these homes if the residents have coverage. In very rare cases, residents can also receive funding from Medicaid if it's determined that they need the support of one of these homes and they have no other way of paying for it. At this level of care, there are two problems that arise that lead to bad outcomes for both residents and staff. The first problem is that insurance providers have much more negotiating power on their pricing, so investors in these facilities can't increase their margins by charging more. Instead, they turn a profit by lowering their standards of care. The National Bureau of Economic Research study found that since for-profit assisted living facilities had no required staffing levels, the headcount of on-site nurses and nursing assistants fell to dangerous levels. The basic functions that these facilities report to offer to patients like bathing, regular medical checkups, and even providing food have been missed because of inadequate funding. A report by the Associated Press listed hundreds of incidents of residents in these facilities simply starving to death. Another report by the Washington Post found that just dozens of elderly patients in the care of these homes died after they simply walked away without being noticed by the skeleton staff running these homes. If a long history of deadly negligence wasn't bad enough, this business model gets even worse since a large share of these residents in these homes were placed there against their will. The age care advocacy group My Elder recently published a story about Max Kaplan, an 80-year-old man who in 2011 went into a hospital to receive a minor surgical procedure, which led him to never seeing his home again. According to the report, the hospital told Max that for them to discharge him back to his home, he would have to agree to allow a social worker to visit his home and determine if it was safe for him to return. The social worker determined his own home was not good enough and put him into the custody of Adult Protective Services, which checked him into an assisted living facility to provide him with care that he was living without before his ill-fated hospital visit. Kaplan was later appointed a legal guardian by a New York court who sold his home and furniture, cashed out his retirement savings, and used the money in addition to his pension and Social Security to pay for his continued care in an assisted living facility. Kaplan is only allowed $50 a month of his own money to pay for incidentals. As of September 2023, when this article was published, Max is not allowed to leave the building for any reason. No one can sign him out, and his guardian was not responsive to requests for comment. Now, you might be thinking this sounds a lot like the movie I Care a Lot, something that sounds like an overdramatic work of fiction. But guardianship abuse happens all the time, especially to elders who have had a lifetime to amass assets worth siphoning off. With a literally captive market, assisted living facilities have very little business pressure to increase their quality of care, because the residents seldom have the ability to leave and find a better provider. The price of assisted living facilities has also grown as facilities have started to offer additional amenities, nicer food, bigger rooms, and more activities to residents that have better insurance coverage or money from retirement savings and home sales to pay out of pocket. These are mostly high-margin items that can be charged at a premium within assisted living facilities to increase revenue because residents have nowhere else to spend their money. It's easier and more lucrative for operators to upsell these services rather than charge more money for what is really needed, which is more staff. And that's the second reason why senior living care is a broken business. It's getting squeezed from all angles. In 2021, a group of Florida healthcare providers urged the FTC for assistance with anti-competitive pricing coming from staffing agencies. So, the operators that have been accused of ripping off residents were themselves complaining about being ripped off by service providers. According to data from Salary.com, ZipRecruiter, and Indeed, the average salary for a full-time elderly caregiver here in California is between $12.34 and $18.27 an hour, or $28,000 to $39,000 a year. That is a terrible income for such a demanding job. So when demand for essential staff peaked during COVID-19, the companies that provided staff to facilities that didn't hire their own staff started charging more, which made it unprofitable to run assisted living facilities. Insurance companies won't pay more, Medicaid has a fixed reimbursement that hasn't been adjusted to keep up with inflation, and facilities are already milking as much as they can out of residents with means to pay for additional services. That's why a survey conducted by the Florida Healthcare Association found that 59% of assisted living facilities were operating at a loss or negative total margin. And if you thought that was bad, then it only gets worse for the third type of aged care facility. Skilled nursing facilities offer the highest level of care to residents with serious health conditions that require constant supervision. These homes are a blend of living accommodations and a hospital, and are funded through fixed Medicare payments or health insurance. Some of the largest aged care communities in America will have independent living, assisted living, and skilled nursing facilities all on a single property, so residents can move between them as their need for care increases as they age. Normally, residents don't spend very long in skilled nursing facilities before they are either moved back to assisted living if their health improves, or the morgue if it doesn't. The regulatory requirements around minimum staffing to run these facilities is very high, but revenue is even lower since by the time most of the population gets to a skilled nursing facility, they don't have any personal assets or insurance coverage left, so providers have to make do with Medicaid, which isn't enough. Since most providers are still run for profit, it's taken some very creative business practices to get money out of these facilities, which is the third reason why everything about aged care has gotten so bad. There is still a lot of money in aged care. It's just not in the operating homes. The National Bureau of Economics research paper outlined one highly controversial practice that private equity firms have been using to extract business value out of all three types of these facilities. Private equity funds are motivated by capital gains, so if they can acquire a struggling aged care company and turn it around, they can make large profits. And even if they can't turn it around, they still have some tricks up their sleeves. So if you're a cunning private equity manager who wants to cash in on the misery, here is what you have to do. You need to find a nursing home that is struggling with profitability, but still has a strong asset base. Some nursing homes own their own facilities, and these are a great target. Since the company is barely profitable, you should be able to buy it for not very much money. And once you can take ownership, immediately sell whatever assets you can and then lease them back to the companies you sold them from. The Aged Care Real Estate Investment Trust that you can buy on a public market get most of their properties from buying and leasing back properties like this. With this pile of new cash, you can pay back your firm a good amount of the money that they spent on the acquisition in the first place. After this, you should buy more properties and then use your market dominance to drive down expenses wherever you can and squeeze out a profit. Once you have made a profit, you can use this to get the aged care facility to take out a loan and then use that money to pay back your firm even more. The ongoing expenses of aged care facilities are now strained by rent and loan repayments, but even if they end up bankrupt, your firm still has made most of its money back. Leveraged buyouts like this have been responsible for 20,000 premature deaths in facilities across the country as the quality of service is slashed in the name of turning a profit. But without the liquidity provided by private equity, there would probably be an even bigger shortage of aged care providers. Private equity isn't moving into aged care because it's a great business. They are moving in because it's a struggling business. Other firms have found that there is more profit in buying up companies that provide third-party services to these homes. In 2018, HIG Capital acquired Reliant Rehabilitation, one of the largest providers of contract healthcare services in America, providing nursing staff on a contract basis to hundreds of assisted living and skilled nursing facilities across the country. This complemented their portfolio nicely, as they were able to share administrative overhead with WellPath, another healthcare service provider they acquired in 2013 that provides the same services to private prisons. I have worked for nearly half a decade in investment banking in the healthcare sector, putting these kinds of deals together. They don't always have to have such bad outcomes, but with such vulnerable people right in the middle of conflicting corporate interests, they are usually the first group to be compromised. The end of the Second World War resulted in a massive spike in fertility across the world that gave rise to the largest generation in history, the aptly named Baby Boomers. Soldiers returned home young, dumb, and full of patriotic spirit. And especially here in America, this family-centered growth coincided with what many believed to be the golden age of capitalism. Homes were cheap, the free market was providing newfangled products to consume, jobs could provide a stable and comfortable living, and the only thing left to do was get busy starting a family. Now, this sounds like such a rose-tinted version of history that borders on being inaccurate, but that doesn't actually matter. Today, we are dealing with expensive homes, overconsumption of disposable consumer junk, and jobs that are extremely insecure. So naturally, the most pressing question for governments around the world is, how to make people make babies again?
Childcare is now more expensive than rent for working families and is costing the economy more than $122 billion a year.
Their childcare expenses from their income taxes. That's a first.
What is the biggest thing that needs to change here in South Korea to make this more appealing for women?
Starting next year, South Korea will pay a childcare allowance of around $530 to parents with newborns.
The biggest issue in 20 years will be population collapse. Not explosion, collapse.
An uncontrolled population decline is a very concerning issue that will have serious impacts on all of us who are planning to live for more than the next 20 years. But it's important to distinguish between people who are concerned about what a population decline represents and people who are concerned about not having a ready stream of available labor produced for them. They may sound similar, but there are two very distinct solutions depending on how you look at the problem or if you even consider it a problem at all. To see why, we need to clear up some history. The exact cause of the 1950s baby boom was not as simple as people just returning home from war and getting to it. The easiest way to see this is that there was no baby boom after the First World War. In fact, after 1918 and a brief dip during the Spanish flu, birth rates dropped to levels very similar to today, which kind of goes against the narrative. If you paid any attention to general media coverage of population collapse, you have probably been told that this is an entirely modern phenomenon caused by, well, whatever problem with the modern world you want to pick. But that's not entirely accurate. In fact, the fertility rate back here was actually worse than it looks. To understand why, you need to understand two numbers. The fertility rate, normally expressed in the number of births per woman, and also the replacement rate. The replacement rate is how many children the average woman needs to have to maintain the population. Today in America, and most other high-income countries, that number is about 2.1 children per woman. The two is because the population is naturally split 50-50 between men and women. So to account for that, the average woman needs to have two children. And the 0.1 is because tragically, some children don't make it to adulthood where they could potentially have children of their own. Now, everybody from politicians across the political spectrum to your weird uncle at Thanksgiving has been paying strangely close attention to national and global fertility rates. But what gets less attention is that the replacement rate is variable too, and it has also been declining. Back in the 1920s, people needed to have more than 3 children on average just to maintain the population, since infant mortality rate was much higher than it is today. That means that the population back here was actually declining faster than it is today. All in the age before modern contraceptives, widespread women in the workforce, the breakdown of family values, or whatever else is blamed for our current population trends. The other explanation for the baby boom was that the post-World War II economy was just so good that starting a family was easy. But the Roaring Twenties were also a highly prosperous post-war economy, and yet people were having a lot fewer babies. The birth rate actually only started recovering after 1929, when the Great Depression plunged a staggering amount of American families back into relative poverty. In fact, by actually looking at the data, you can see that the baby boom really started in the 1930s, when the American economy was arguably in its worst state in the last century. There was a pause during the war, but the post-war baby boom that we are all familiar with was really just the continuation of a trend that had already started. So if it wasn't contraceptives, women in the workforce, economic growth, the move into cities, or modern family values, what actually caused the birth rate slump back then? Well, it's the same thing that caused the baby boom. And the reason I am giving you this history lesson is because it could also solve a lot of our population problems today, but you might not like the answer. One of the most consistent baby blockers is income inequality. The economist Thomas Piketty, as part of writing his book Capital in the 21st Century, collected and compiled income inequality data over the last century. Just quickly, this is probably one of the best books on economics ever written, and it reads easily even to non-economists. So, like always, I will leave a link to it in the description below. Using my link helps the channel a little bit, and a good book will provide way more value than I ever could through something like a Patreon. But anyways, if you invert the data that Piketty collected on income inequality, it lines up almost perfectly with the fertility rate. If people feel like they aren't falling behind, if they have social mobility, and they can provide what is considered a good life, they will have more children. The New Deal, that was the foundation of the Great Depression recovery efforts and the GI Bill following World War II, massively reduced income inequality. And with it, the babies flowed. But this is a big problem because, yes, people in power want to avoid a population crunch. But not like that. For most of human history, our population has been pretty much stagnant. Based on archaeological records, the average population growth rate for the 10,000 years between the dawn of human civilization and the Industrial Revolution was just 0.04%. Generation to generation, it was barely enough to register. And even then, there were significant setbacks like the Black Plague, which wiped out between a quarter and half of all people in Europe. People had a lot more children on average, but fewer of them survived, so the population didn't really budge. And then came the Industrial Revolution, which kicked off a bit of a feedback loop. Mechanized industry and agriculture could feed and provide more people, and more people meant more work could be done, and more innovations could be made to feed and provide for more people. Refinements in medicine and nutrition meant that people also lived a lot longer, which gave them more opportunities to apply their expertise to making an overall wealthier world. By best estimates, something like 7% of all of the humans to have ever lived are currently alive right now, and that's been great for business. Having more people naturally boosted industry, because there were more potential consumers to cater to, and population growth provided a ready supply of labor to work in the new factories. Early industrial centers like London became extremely rich, but even back then, some familiar trends emerged. Cities during the Industrial Revolution were horrible places to live. They figured out building factories much faster than building sanitation. So infectious diseases, malnutrition, and foodborne pathogens were more prevalent in these population-dense centers. So many people died in London that up until the 20th century, it was almost entirely reliant on people moving from the countryside to get work to maintain its population. Now, most cities in high-income countries, with the notable exception of San Francisco, eventually figured out that leaving human waste in the street was not a good idea. So even though cities aren't actively killing their inhabitants anymore, they are still population black holes that have very low birth rates and rely on people moving to them to maintain themselves. That's simply because cities are expensive. Unless you are extremely wealthy, you probably can't afford a family-sized home close to a major city. And depending on your career, you might not be able to move away from those cities without losing your job. Today, a trend has emerged where having lots of children is either an indication of being extremely wealthy or being extremely poor, with very little room in the middle for large middle-class families, because that's just become unaffordable in most cities around the world. Now, over the past 300 years, we have also run out of people to pull from the high birth rate countryside. So the trend has gone global, and today, most advanced economies pull in people from high birth rate countries. The rise in immigration to fill labor shortages has masked the issue, but it has caused other problems like further contributing to housing affordability and putting downward pressure on wages and upward pressure on income inequality. There is also the not-so-subtle reality that a lot of the people that want a stable supply of young workers would, let's just say, strongly prefer if those workers were homegrown. Now, in all of this, there is one other simple solution. Let people work jobs outside of the city. The COVID pandemic was the most recent global event to shake up birth rates. Initially, it caused a sharp dip as people lost their jobs and saw hospitals barely having the capacity to manage the load. But as more dual-income households moved to working from home, births increased and not only made up for the initial drop, but exceeded expected trends. Unsurprisingly, it's easier to deal with a pregnancy and have children when parents don't need to go into an office. It allows people to live in cheaper and more family-friendly communities further away from commercial centers. Now, this reality is rustling some jimmies because companies want people to move back into the office for a variety of reasons. But the good news is that we actually have some power over this. Even with extreme measures, it's very hard to force people to have children. So if businesses won't entertain policies to promote equality or let people work from home, they don't get their future workers and consumers. If you want further evidence of the benefits of moving away from the office, look no further than the CEOs themselves that are demanding that workers return to the office while they don't actually show up to work at all.